So hello and welcome to episode 15 of ID Cast. My name is Brad Harper and I am an industrial design recruiter. Today, me and Drew are joined by LinkedIn's number one startup, Arrival. With design playing a key part of their evolution, we caught up with Chief of Product Patrick Bion and Chief Design Officer Jeremy Offer to see what all the fuss was about. If you like this content, drop us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or alternatively, drop us a message to hello@designtruth.co.uk if you ever want to be involved. We really appreciate the support so far on the podcast, so thank you for listening. There for a while, Jeremy, so you've seen this whole kind of shift from, I mean, how many people were there when you started?
Well, there was a bunch of engineers it was probably about 20 people, if that. I was consulting for a year and a half before I actually joined.
Wow.
So it's been quite a journey.
Yeah.
gone from whatever it is, 20 people to 1,200 people.
Wow.
I've been there since the beginning, more or less.
Yeah, good stuff. And has it been anything like you've experienced ever before?
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, I don't think there are many companies, unless you join Tesla at the beginning or, I don't know, Google at the beginning. It feels like that kind of,
Would you put it in that bracket?
Well, I mean, actually, Patrick would be better placed to tell you that than me. Having
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there are some very strong similarities, for sure. Yeah. And I think the common point that Jeremy has linked to Google and other tech teams is just the far-reaching approach that we're trying to, you know, the level of problems we're trying to solve and the scalability that the company's trying to got, that level of ambition. Mm. And the scale of things that we're trying to take on ourselves to make sure we can do that correctly is unparalleled to many other teams right now. And Tesla are fairly close in that regard because they've, to the same sort of regard, they've taken on a lot of complex things which other big teams wouldn't even consider. So a lot of people join Arrival, and they think they know what they're getting into, and they think they know what the company is and what it's about. And then after day one, they're just deer in the headlights because they're like, oh my God, there's so much happening. I didn't realize you were doing this. I didn't realize you were doing that.
I wrote a piece actually for Desk, magazine.
Yeah, I was reading that earlier.
Okay. Yeah, well, I was talking about, I think one of the questions was around the sort of disruptive element of, you know, trying to do things differently and where the challenges came from. And my point was that actually a lot of the challenges came from a lot of the types of people we were employing in the early days.
Mm.
And they were so entrenched in a traditional automotive OEM way of thinking that they just couldn't think outside of that sort of route from, you know, concept to production in the way that they were used to dealing with things. Mm. So, for example, the design team have all come from design consulting backgrounds rather than automotive design backgrounds. The engineers have come, a lot of those guys are actually industrial design trained. I mean, Patrick himself did a degree in industrial design. So the sort of kind of lateral thinking mindset of creating the sort of paradigm shift that we're trying to do here is much more suited to a sort of design thinking mode of operandi than it is a traditional kind of linear engineering approach.
Mm. It really comes across as well in the limited information that you can get at the moment still about the, I was going to say products, but I suppose that's the closest word I've got at the moment. From what I've seen, certainly, the UPS van, for example, it comes across very quickly that you've thought more about the user journey and the use case of the product rather than, yeah, okay, it's a van, and what can we do with the van?
A lot of us came from, I was a director of a service design business before this, and it's very much that kind of approach of thinking about the challenges to the stakeholders that And when I say stakeholders, I mean the operators, the passengers, the cleaners, anybody who kind of revolves around the vehicles that we're producing. And I think that's been the, I think one of the most exciting challenges actually is taking it from a user experience point of view initially, and then the form and the kind of look and feel of the vehicle is the easy bit, really. That's the bit that kind of comes out of all of that research. And really all we're doing, and it's not rocket science, and there have been many designers who've done it very successfully before, which is just reduce every single element to its simplest form to if really kind of distill the operation of the vehicle. So we're trying to guide people into, so if take our bus, for example, we're trying to guide people into how they navigate through the payment system, getting on board the bus, taking a seat, all the way through to when the cleaners at the end of the day, you know, can mop right underneath the seat because they're completely cantilevered and there's no supports, some visible support structures to get in the way. So all of these little kind of nuggets, if you like, of these pain points that we've tried to overcome have really informed the overall design aesthetic. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Brilliant. I did this on our last episode. What I did was we started chatting, and about 15 minutes in, I realized I hadn't actually introduced the people that we had on. So
I didn't even realize we'd started.
Yeah, that basically, if you've not actually listened to our podcast yet, we set this up during kind of lockdown. I'm not sure if you've listened to us, Patrick, because I know you got in touch really in the early days when we were like episode one and we didn't even know how to edit a video. basically, we put it together during a period of time when everyone was either working from home, like probably on the quest of furlough or whatever. No one knew what was going on. And we thought what we'd do is we'd come together and just try and get as many different unique perspectives of what was happening right now in the industry. So we've spoken to people that have worked, trying to think, we've had on people that are experiencing working in China in a time when that was all completely locking down. We've had people from the agency kind of side of things. We just had Merle on at Gunnerda 4. We've had designers on that used to work for the likes of Samsung, Joseph, chatting about kind of some startup stuff that they had going on. And what's come out of it is just that everyone's going through their own unique challenge, unique set of problems. And when me and Drew started this, we had a few lists of people that we wanted to get on and companies we wanted to talk to. And Arrival were probably definitely on the top of my list, just from kind of my own experience of being involved in a little bit in the journey over the last couple of years. So just if you could just kind of quickly introduce yourselves, that would be pretty cool. It would have been called Charge at the time, yep. And the Kinetic Group. So you've seen this full evolution of...
Yeah, I actually joined Kinetic.
Okay.
It was almost run like a small family business at the time. Mm. We had a small office in Mayfair. And that was essentially the holding company for a number of businesses, including River Race and what is now Charge, and Arrival. Prior to joining, I was consulting for a year and a half, on two of our sort of main vehicles, jumped ship and came on board to basically build an in-house design team. We were using a lot of consultants at the time, and Dennis, our CEO, his vision really was to build an in-house design outfit, which we've now grown to about 25 people across industrial design. And then, of course, we've got Kwame Nyaning, who's heading up the experience design team as well. So
he's recently joined, isn't he?
That's right.
Okay, brilliant. So, and you're based... I still take it.
You're based at home.
you're based at home, yeah. But are you guys at home at the minute, or?
It's kind of an optional thing, really. I mean, we're trying to have sort of days where we do go into the office, and they're more for kind of group workshops and more of a sort of, I guess, a cultural coming together rather than any kind of necessarily productive work issues. That's actually worked really smoothly, and we've really embraced a few online tools. I mean, there's one in particular, Miro or Miro, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but that's been an amazing collaborative tool in terms of setting up workshops, just throwing concept sketches and renderings onto onto various boards, and you can make comments. You can really work collaboratively, and then using instant messaging apps like Telegram to keep in touch with our team members, and you know, almost like a sort of WhatsApp group for the business. And it's been a very fluid transition. I mean, it's not that different from how we communicated with one another and across the business, especially as we've got so many sectors of the business across the world. You know, remote working actually has been something that we've adapted to pretty successfully, I would say.
Yeah. Is it to a point where you would even thinking about future hiring and scaling up, and is it to a point where we'd actually take someone on remotely, or do you still want that feeling of they need to be?
Absolutely. We're looking at a guy at the moment who's based in Stockholm. Okay. We don't plan to bring him on board. We have two designers, actually three designers out in Minsk in Belarus.
Wow.
And they come over and you know, spend a week or two with us at any one time, and then they go back. But no, the communication channels that we now have are so intuitive and instinctive for us to use. And as designers, where we're dealing with assets that are mainly visual, you know, it's absolutely a no-brainer working remotely like this.
Brilliant.
It's made the company and all teams a lot more conscious of why you come to the office and how you plan your time with different teams, rather than just defaulting, oh, it's 8 o'clock, get up, go to the office kind of thing. So we still have, we're still in the office a couple of days a week here and there, but again, no pressure, you know, to come in and review a package pack or a prototype together is super vital. But you just see a bit more of a clear divide between, okay, I'm going to be in the office these days, let's tackle these three or four things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got some protected time. And I think, to Jeremy's point, it's flipped that model on its head in terms of time in the office, time at home. And we've got guys in the US that will now be working with us, because when they can travel, they will. And until then, we're all effectively in remote somewhere. So
I've got, I think it's last count, three members of my team who I've only met once. Oh, wow. I mean, I'm not saying this is a good thing. I'm just using this as an indication of how we were able to adapt. You know, we talk daily over Zoom. In fact, one guy I thought for about 3 months was about 5'9", but he happens to be 6'2". there are challenges, absolutely. And in terms, you know, as a manager, trying to coordinate and just catch the sort of nuances of body language and understanding how your team members are getting on from day to day. Obviously, you've got these sort of virtual blinkers on, and you kind of. You do tend to find yourself working in a slightly more siloed way than you would do if you were in an office.
Mm.
But I would say that really is one of the main. That's the only real kind of downside to it is that kind of collective team spirit that you get from all working in one room.
Yeah, so brilliant. And obviously, Patrick, you're more of a chief of product, so it's obviously subtly different to what Jeremy's doing. And is it? Give us a bit of an insight in terms of what that involves for you, because I imagine on one of the product verticals of Arrival. Yeah,
that's right. So we have quite a diverse range of products that we're working on in the company, and so we've broken the teams up to help focus that a little bit. So as chief of product for our lightweight vehicles, I'm responsible for the design, engineering, and the delivery of our product, our programs. So it's quite a holistic role covering. Everything from electrical engineering through to ergonomics, and the rest of the vehicles. So, and we have a very, very small team working on these vehicles. And as we've touched on in the past, it's a very, very diverse group of people from different backgrounds, and that has a really positive impact on the product. We've got people that have specialised in automotive areas, and we've got people that have come from consumer electronics or other devices. So it's a special team we have here.
And that, from the sound of what we were saying before, Jeremy, that sounds like that was a conscious choice for having that diversity of background rather than this typical.
It wasn't so much a conscious choice. We didn't actually go out and say, right, you know what, we're not going to hire anybody from the automotive industry. It's just the tropes, the personality tropes that we were getting that had come from, you know, the OEM sector. Tended to be more into a kind of less of a startup mindset, should we say, less there wasn't so much of a desire to think outside of the box that they'd been put in at their previous job. As I say, the design thinking process, it just kind of acted as a bit of a magnet for a lot of like-minded souls. You know, I mean, we've got people on my team. We've got, you know, a fine artist who spends 2 days a week doing graffiti art. You know, it's the type of thought process and the kinds of minds that we want to get in. We've got, you know, roboticists from NASA. Who've joined us. So there are massive extremes of personality types and skill sets that we've managed to kind of just pull together, really. And it's been an amazing journey to see the types of individuals that are excited to work for us.
And on the product design, we're fundamentally, as a company, strategically trying to solve problems that other teams haven't solved before. And inherently, that means you need people that can approach them in a different way. And you can... You can read someone's CV or interview them, and they say, "I'm innovative, or I think differently, or I'm open to new ideas." But it's not about that. It's when you bring people in that have gone through a design process where they question the first principles of why I think something's been done. They have to go and bottom up for themselves. Why can't they produce that with injection molding? You know, they have to work in that kind of critiquing way. And when you bring people in that don't know the answers, they ask the right questions. Whereas when you bring people in that have done it before, they don't ask those questions. And when their team aren't asking the right questions, you miss the opportunities. We've got one of the guys you just mentioned, Brad, who we brought into the team a long while ago from a product design background, is now leading a lot of our automotive systems, quite complex technical systems.
Yeah. But not automotive trained in any sense.
No, but just really understands how to make good decisions with good design judgment on what kind of technologies are now, what we can do later.
What we need to do is that we need to back up a lot of the sort of more creative, out of the box thinking, and we have got a lot of those guys, and girls, but it's underpinned by some seriously good competitive automotive engineering production talent, and the closer we get to full production, the more of these guys we need to really help us understand some of the nuanced difficulties of actually scaling from prototype to mass production.
Yeah, you need the balance. It's a really good point. There's no point having a team of people that have never built a vehicle before, hacking their way through it for 5 years. You need that balance. And I think as a team, we've got to the sweet spot now of having a really complementary way of bringing people together that can accept that someone that's never designed a metal stamping before is going to ask the right question, and you can just work with them.
There's not a lot of teeth sucking going on, you know. There's not a lot of people kind of shaking their heads going, "What are we?" I mean, there were. Don't get me wrong. That was. I often say that there's a metaphor I've used before, which is the arrival in the early days was a bit like the formation of a new landmass. You know, there was a huge amount of volcanic activity. There were people getting fired left, right, and centre. People who weren't kind of fitting in, who were arguing and leaving, and we had a lot of contractors who were, you know, on a sort of short-term basis. And slowly and surely the land started to settle, and you know that kind of that ethic that we kind of imbued in the whole team started to really take hold, and now we're starting to see that kind of, you know, to take the analogy to its conclusion, that kind of that, I guess, the growth of the greenery. And the fruits of that
fruits of the labor,
yeah, absolutely.
So if I may, we were talking to Merle last week from KD, and we were talking a lot about the culture within a team, and not only finding the right sort of breadth of skill sets as you've talked about, but finding the right type of character fits as well. She had a very quotable rule.
Just no dickheads.
I would say no egos. I think that's the main thing that we don't. We're not an ego driven business. And you know, we don't go around talking about how we're going to change the world. You know, it's much more kind of subtle than that. You know, if what we do is as good as we hope it is, and we say that in a very humble way, then we may well change public transport or you know, some of the sort of transit infrastructures within our cities.
Yeah.
But the people that we have on board don't think about in those terms. You know, they so we recently hired a guy from one of the OEM automotive industries, actually, having said we don't have too many. And he was really surprised how we weren't set up like a kind of design competition within the design team, that, you know, where all the designers get to do the concepts and then one person's concept is chosen and they're the kind of, you know, the hallowed designer who then takes that through to production and everybody else has to sort of slave away, turning their design into a production vehicle. We don't think like that at all. You know, we have very, very collaborative workshops where there is no one person who owns the design of the vehicle. Everybody is inputting at a level. And we've got a very flat structure. You know, we've a lot of our guys, just simply because we needed to get up and running quickly, are quite senior. So there is a mindset of been there and done it, and actually we're here to really create something amazing, which hopefully will go on, as I say, to do some great things, but without shouting about it. We're not really about what we've done. We haven't really, you know, we've not done it yet.
Yeah.
we're in that process of discovery and really kind of engendering that culture that we tried really hard to build.
It's always difficult to try and translate like the output of a company's products and its design philosophy into the day-to-day. Like how do you link that to? And you've mentioned like no dickheads, no egos, but I like to think that in our team, the best idea presents itself and the best idea succeeds. And if everyone kind of buys into that, then it's not about, well, I know you've said that, but I'm your boss. So actually, you know, none of that just doesn't exist. And if you've got the right people that can foster that and hold everyone accountable to that, then it gets the best from everyone ultimately. But it does lead to, check your ego at the door, because you're going to get found out pretty soon.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's a place where you're never going to be the smartest person in the room.
No.
You've got to take part in that, right? That sounds hard, but I want to hire people that fundamentally are far more intelligent than me. I just want to manage them, and that's the brilliant thing about the company. Yeah,
brilliant.
And I've definitely been in those company cultures where it is very much sort of, well, okay, you're going to lead this project, you're going to lead this project, and then there is a certain handwriting or a certain character that comes through with that. I don't necessarily think that's the best way to do it. I think it is. I think it is always good to take that as a team approach, and you know, you'll have those sessions where you need everybody involved, and then ultimately, there's certain decisions that need to be made. But I always think if you're one team, and certainly if you're a burgeoning team that's building a culture, that it's important to have as much of that breadth of input as possible. So. It sounds super interesting. It sounds really exciting. It sounds like it would be a fun place to kind of be not overwhelmed, but certainly whelmed routinely by the other brains in the room.
Mm. Yeah,
you become a little bit overwhelmed some days because that's the pace at which we work. And I think if you're too comfortable, you've probably got a surprise coming your way.
Yeah. And just to kind of wrap up, kind of intros, obviously kind of Jeremy, also Patrick, for you coming from Tesla. Now, what was it like from, was it your first job at Tesla? If your LinkedIn is correct, was that your first position was in design? It seems like a crazy first job to go into.
In hindsight, it was a crazy first job.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very fortunate to have found the opportunity. And I think as with the design industry and as with your recruit, it came through knowing that, you know, someone knowing me and recommending me for the job. And no, super lucky. It was an amazing team. Absolutely loved it, to be honest. It was hard graft, but you had a really hard work, but you had just the most ridiculously capable team all around you. And Tesla is quite unique in that just everyone bought into what we were trying to do at that time. And the most critical path just trumped everything, and everyone, whatever it took, we found a way. And when I first moved out there, people were like, what are you doing? Why are you moving to America to go work for this complete unknown company who are probably designing golf carts? Like, what are you doing? Like, and it's just really telling of the times that the past few years in the automotive industry and electric vehicles, that suddenly Tesla's such a household name. Super lucky to have worked from one crazy team to another.
Brilliant.
Good. Actually, we interviewed Patrick as an industrial designer, taking him to my team. And he didn't pass the interview. But he's obviously gone on to do much better things heading up a whole vehicle program now. So
Brilliant. I was kind of doing a little bit of research earlier and watching the whole kind of fully charged kind of setup you did there. The only reason why I mentioned Tesla is when you think of Tesla, you think of the gigafactory, right? You think of that kind of setup, but you guys are almost flipping, well, like you've already totally. Said, flipping everything on its head, every thought Absolutely. Process you can think of.
Well, actually, you know, that very centralized, huge manufacturing infrastructure is well, as you say, we completely turned that on its head. We're much more about smaller, bespoke microfactories that can be positioned around the globe to cater for a local market.
Have you got any good examples of how, especially, I appreciate you guys who can't go into kind of complete kind of detail, but I was just interested really kind of looking at the model. Is, are there any kind of tangible examples you can give of where, when you address things on a regional level, where that can have an impact on the actual design of the vehicle? Is there any kind of tangibles of, say, of where there can be subtle changes at all?
Yeah, we do have. I think commercial vehicles are really broad, say, and lots of different. Every vehicle process is so optimized, and the vehicle needs to be so efficient that if you try and use a really small vehicle, where companies are using very big ones, and that's the trouble companies face right now is they're trying to buy electric vehicles. A, they're expensive, or B, they aren't the right ones, and so they're compromising. And so we have some big fleets that have in the US they use a certain type of vehicle which is a little bit bigger, in the UK slightly smaller. And I think when you can optimize each facility to build a certain type of vehicle based on where it's used. So whether a vehicle's used in the middle of Kansas or whether it's used in New York City. Mm. And now to try and cater to that product offering with one centralized production facility, which is very difficult. And I think it's not about necessarily having one vehicle set for a facility, but it's about designing the vehicles in such a way that the technologies are universal across all of your vehicles and you produce them in the same way. And so that gives you the flexibility to offer different vehicle types in smaller volumes, basically.
Yeah, and
I think that cost offering, that price parity with an ICE vehicle was very much part of the initial kind of USP, if you like, of the company. And the idea that we can build vehicles in small volumes and not have to charge the earth for them, you know, was key to this. So we set out actually developing our own body system, because we realized very early on that in order to have the sort of flexibility to be able to create more sort of bespoke builds, we couldn't amortize the cost of a steel tool for a metal stamping across the volumes of any one particular vehicle. So, you know, you're spending hundreds of millions of pounds on hardened steel tools to stamp aluminium. And actually that just wasn't feasible for us. It never would have been. So the idea of creating a sustainable material that we could mold in very low volumes and using low pressure techniques that required very little tooling or cheap tooling, that we could actually use the tooling process for our prototypes as well as going on to mass production, was a real kind of a kind of genesis moment for us. It really was, and you know, to that end, we our chief of materials has got a huge amount of experience in. I mean, he literally wrote the book on materials, the idea that bringing somebody on board simply to turn what has effectively been the process of body panel manufacture since the days they hammered them out as, you know, individual panel beaters, to turn that on its head and to, over the last 2 years, develop from scratch our own bespoke material and process to be able to mass produce body systems has been one of the real successes that we've had so far.
The comparison to Tesla is quite interesting, because Tesla, and there's no, you know, there are merits and problems with the two different manufacturing approaches of small facilities, microfactories versus big centralized facilities. But we've, you know, partly because of what Tesla's done, we've been able to solve problems a little bit differently. And day one, we kind of looked and reflected at what the industry's doing well, what its problems are, and why Tesla have been very lucky. Like, there have been points where that company's been right on the cusp of financial ruin, and it got through because they're an amazing team and got led by a visionary. But It's hard work setting up a new automotive team and trying to build products at the right price point and at the right quality. So we've had to basically go and solve a lot of big, substantial technologies to enable us to do that. And to your point, you don't try and do that by doing the same thing that Daimler and Iveco do, because they're already doing it. So yeah, we've had to rethink, to Jeremy's point, rethink material technologies quite a lot. The architecture of the vehicle, robotics, drive units, battery modules, all of our computing platforms, all designed, engineered ourselves.
A lot of it came out of the frustration of dealing with tier one suppliers.
Oh, okay.
So again, it's a bit of a cartel. The automotive industry buys brake systems from, you know, Brembo, or they buy systems from Bosch or whatever it is. But in order to get them even to, you know, get out of bed, to use that analogy, you need to give them £1 million before they'll even think about it. So the kind of frustrations that we felt as a startup, you know, these guys wouldn't really listen to us. They weren't really interested in working with us. And if they did, they were going to charge, you know, X million pounds to develop a system for us. And it became a real point of contention, to the point where our CEO, Dennis, said, right, well, let's just become completely vertically integrated and let's design and manufacture all of our own components. So motors, gearboxes, inverters, batteries, all of those have been developed in-house and given the same level of design attention as the exterior and the interior of our vehicles as well. Yeah. So, you know, in typical kind of Apple fashion, if you like, if you take the lid off an Apple Mac, everything is beautifully laid out. And that's not just because we want it to look pretty. It is because by rationalizing the design of every single component, we can stack them in a way that creates the slimmest, smallest, most compact package that we can possibly achieve. And so this idea of these, what we call sort of grid architecture, if you like, so stacking our components in such a rational way that there is literally sort of millimeters of space between them. Whereas if you're buying components from tier one suppliers, you might get a form factor that you're trying to sort of shoehorn into one particular little cavity in the vehicle and another one over here. And you haven't got that kind of harmony. So that ground up approach where we're designing everything and integrating everything into the platform is key to creating this this scalable modular architecture that we
It's one of the things that really piqued my interest as well when I was looking at how you guys are approaching things is one is the modular build and working business to business to garner that insight before then going direct to customer. I wonder, like, where was that? Was that an early on decision, or was that something that's that after you decided, well, actually, we need to make everything in house and start building this? Is that something that was more organic?
No, the business to business sale model was definitely a very early on design idea, because it's one of the best applications for electric vehicles right now. Fundamentally, electric vehicles may not make sense for every consumer out there. You've got one vehicle and occasionally you go and see your family in Devon, for example. You know, there are reasons why electric vehicles don't make sense, but where they absolutely make sense and where they could have been, they could be, you know, been sold and used in large volumes is in commercial applications. And we all, you know, when was the last time we all purchased something on Amazon? Probably
20 minutes ago.
We'll be here tomorrow, right? So, you know, in terms of areas where we can all benefit our natural environment, moving diesel miles in a commercial environment to electric makes sense. And for a business, you know, you go through a lot of risk setting up a new team, setting up supply chain, testing, R&D, etc. When you do that to then try and sell directly to consumers and you're competing for their sale, it's high risk. Right? Whereas for us, we've got guaranteed orders in the bank where we know what product customers want, when they're going to get it. And that finance and that business longevity is quite well known quite early on.
Yeah, Jeremy.
I was going to say, just to follow up on that, I mean, because a lot of the logistics companies operate in this sort of closed loop circuit, you know, they know their routes, they know how many miles they're going to be doing, they know that the vehicle will be back to one particular base where you can control the infrastructure, which kind of lends itself much more to the charging infrastructure that we're putting in.
So in terms of those orders, they're pretty substantial, aren't they, from what I can read online?
Yeah, there are a lot coming in we're not talking about, which is
sure.
yeah, I mean, teams like UPS and quite a lot of others here in the UK. It's it's just an amazing opportunity to go and work with a big fleet that knows their products inside out. They've been using them for 40 years. They know what breaks first. They know what step height they want. You know, they know everything about their vehicles. And to work with them closely in the design process is an amazing opportunity. And it sounds like why they're doing that with us. They're doing that with us because they know they can't do that with any other vehicle manufacturer. You know, these big teams have been buying vehicles for, you know, a number of years now, and they try and request minute changes to the product.
Exactly.
They make 500,000 of the same product. They're like, no, you're going to keep coming back to us, so why would we change the product? And that's what's UPS, for example, they've never ordered vehicles of this size before, ever, because it's just not the way the business works. Whereas when they can get a guaranteed product in terms of its ergonomics, its range, its price, it's a massive opportunity for them. And we're seeing a lot of fleets around the world that understand that.
And how do you go about getting that user insight once you've got that development partner, that customer? How do you go about learning about that? Very.
I was going to say that it's been a process of co-creation. So our partners, particularly UPS, have been on board since the beginning. So they've able to. You know, we talk about the user experience. They've been there and done it. They know exactly what they need from a vehicle. So we've been able to funnel all of these insights into the design and the engineering of the vehicles, in order to cater for a market that they're always going to know better than we are. So whereas say, you know, an OEM selling an off the shelf van, you know, it's take it or leave it. Maybe there are a few kind of minor tweaks they can do to if the order's big enough, but it is essentially the same vehicle that gets sold to everybody. Whereas because of the micro factories, because of the more kind of bespoke production methods that we're using, and the scalable production methods that we're using, we can build almost to order. You know, we are building vehicles for customers' requirements.
Yeah. And it really comes across in the way that, again, I watched the Robert Llewellyn video earlier. And the way that he was able to walk without stooping, without having to step too high, I just thought that really demonstrated that someone had just sort of taken that wide view and gone, that looks like a pain in the arse of a van to do. let's change that. The thing that the guy has to climb in and out of, let's just make it something he can walk in.
And we're not afraid to sort of tear it up and start again as well. Say start again. We're not afraid to, you know, reinvent something that we've already designed. So, you know, normally on a production process, on a design and development process, you get to the alpha build, and then the alpha build transitions into the beta build, and it's the same vehicle. Whereas we had so many learnings from that alpha vehicle that were fed into the second iteration, the beta vehicle, which, you know, there are some substantial design changes and engineering changes, but all of that was driven through the customer requirements.
Yeah.
I mean, Patrick can testify to the challenges of actually, you know, making that decision in the first place. You know what? We're gonna change this design, and we're gonna change it dramatically. And let's not be precious about what we've already created. Yes, it had an iconic form factor that everybody liked, but there were some fundamental challenges about, say, the ingress egress. Getting in and out of the vehicle that couldn't have been, you know, would have been such a challenge to productionize given that existing form factor, that the move to the beta vehicle was a bit of a no brainer.
To your point, on design process, that we work in a very fast way in terms of how we design and evaluate things. We build a lot of very fast package bucks and door models and everything that we can do to get insights as quickly as possible. And we do that with a number of customers. And the challenge for us is really trying to take all of these requirements from different customers and be strong enough to say, we think you don't need that, even though you've done that for 40 years. Here's why. Here's something better. And physically prove it with them quite quickly. A vehicle development process is quite a slow, long duration. I think if you can highlight the learnings really quickly with big teams, it gives us a really good advantage.
Was UPS a bit of a landmark moment, do you think?
I think the order, communicating the order.
10,000 units is a pretty landmark.
10,000 units for a new company is a landmark. And it's the thing about UPS is, like, if there was some company that none of us has heard of that ordered 10,000 vehicles, you might start looking. But UPS, you know, they know their vehicles better than almost any other fleet does. And so it is quite a comment from them, certainly, that they want to work with us and invest in us as well, because I think they they see the underlying strategy, not just a better van.
Any other moments, Jeremy, particularly because you've been there so from such early on, if you kind of get to a point where you now have a beer after work and look back on the last 4 years, what kind of springs to mind to you of moments and challenges and kind of wins that have happened along the way?
I think it's just seeing the inspirational attitudes that everybody has around the business, and seeing that grow and be nurtured by, you know, an amazing an amazing management team, but also, you know, a lot of the sort of talent team as well. Those guys are as excited to be working in the business as anybody, you know, and that comes across when you're trying to bring new people into the business. And things like, you know, getting the top spot on LinkedIn's best startups to work for. You know, these are all kind of, they're not so much sort of tangible metrics. They are, it's just about the culture that we've built. And that was really important to us at the beginning of the business, is to find people who thought and felt the same way that we did. And we wanted it to be fun. You know, we're not on this planet for a long time, and we want to be here and enjoy ourselves and do what we do and not plow through it on a 9-to-5 and you know, go home disgruntled. We want to be excited, you know, from the moment our head hits the pillow to when we wake up and be excited about the challenges of that of the next day. And that, I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but genuinely, you know, everybody literally thinks like that.
We've been in stealth mode for a long time, and we haven't talked about what we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it. And we've all just become quite immune to what we're trying to do and the impact it might have in the world. And when you bring new people on and they come in, get in, they go, wow, that's actually genuinely, or you get investors like Hyundai and Kia and these other teams that come in, and
yeah,
they look at what we're trying to do and they realize that, wow, this could really change some of the things. That's always a nice external validation. I think the more and more our products start getting out there, the more we'll see that.
We had a very, very senior executive come to visit the factory, who's ex-BMW. They've been there and done it, and he was bowled over by what we were doing. You know, the idea that we're trying to sort of change the way that vehicles are manufactured, designed and manufactured. The OEMs are not doing it. They can't do it. And that is the reason, to Patrick's point, why companies like Hyundai have invested with us, because we're nimble enough and we're agile enough to be able to almost act as their kind of their skunk works, if you like. You know, we're a team, we're a small enough and agile enough team to be able to develop things without the fear of a big corporation behind us to you know, disrupt you know, the work that we're doing. So that idea that we are this sort of I guess this team of kind of garage this stealth garage R&D facility for a company like Hyundai is actually quite appealing to me.
Yeah, what was it like going out of stealth mode? Because obviously you've been working super hard for a number of years, and then there was that point where someone obviously ticked a button and said, "Right, we're going to show the world what we're doing." Yeah, can you remember? Can you remember being in the office that day, or remember just?
Well, we actually started showing the world relatively early on. We had an article in Wired magazine. Back in, I think, 2016, late 2016, and the vehicle, if you search back online for that, it's a very, very different beast than it is now.
Is that the Royal Mail van?
Well, there was the Royal Mail, but there was a vehicle, there was a concept that went out before that. It was effectively about as simple a form as you could possibly get, but then you start adding things like aerodynamics, and you start to really kind of identify what the challenges are of building a vehicle and designing a vehicle. And we went out naively to begin with.
Did you, because you mentioned that you hired so many industrial designers rather than automotive designers necessarily, did you feel compelled to learn automotive design skills? Like, did you start making one-to-one scale clay prototypes? Any of that?
No, absolutely not. You know, we've blocked all of those trends. So, I mean, to get technical for a minute, things like Alias, which is the A surfacing tool that a lot of designers will use. If you go to an OEM, and I'm sorry to keep comparing this to an OEM, but it's the only kind of metric I've got in terms of our R&D process. But, you know, they may have 30 alias designers, and they may be, you know, one of them's modeling the wing mirror and the other's modeling a hubcap or a wheel trim or whatever. And the kind of job satisfaction of that is not great. And also the time that it takes to craft something like that, you know, when you're they normally go through this process of alias modeling and then into ISOM, which is like the production surface modeling tool, before it even gets to the engineers. Whereas we have two alias modelers for the whole company, and one of them is responsible for the entire vehicle. So giving people that level of control over their output is actually, you know, that has made his job satisfaction, you know, so much higher than it was when he was at the OEM weekend.
Do you know what? That's such a nice thing to hear, because we've talked about this on the podcast before. When I was about 15, 16, I was going to be a car designer. There was no discussion. And then I saw the designs on your .. series on BBC Two. And it occurred to me, there's a few other things that I saw, but it occurred to me that if I was going to be a car designer, chances are I was going to design a piece of a car.
Yeah.
For 30 years. Maybe it's a gear knob, maybe it's a wing mirror, as you say. But if I was going to draw, if I was going to spend my life drawing maybe a lamp one week and then a bin the next week, that's really cool because I get to draw the whole thing.
Yeah.
I get to figure out how it's going to be used and what's exciting about it and who it is that's going to use it and what's really frustrating about the existing bin or lamp.
Yeah.
And then you think, yeah, that gives you a lot of like an opportunity to make a real improvement. So it's very cool to hear that you've got that level of the sort of the cohesion in the design. And that
being smart about it is the element here. So whereas an alias designer in a traditional scenario might model absolutely everything, so every single component is modeled. An alias is not the quickest tool. It's, you know, it's a surface modeler. You've got to stitch it. There's no history. You've got to start again, more or less, if there are design changes. So we're really clever about it. We'll only model things in alias that actually really are really important when it comes to sort of highlights running over the side of the vehicle, for example. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we're modeling a steering wheel or a gear knob, which is going to have a, you know, it's going to be made of textured plastic or whatever, then we'll use a solid modeling tool like NX, and we'll just think smartly about where we actually use the tools.
I think your point, Drew, about interest in what you're doing, I often worry about bringing people in from design consultancies to come and work on in a vehicle environment, because often vehicles are seen as I say, it's a very long, slow, three or five year program. But actually, for design engineers and industrial designers, vehicles are pretty extreme, because they cover every manufacturing process that you can think of. You're going to learn it at some point in the vehicle. Mm. You're going to learn ergonomics and user experience from digital products to physical. You're going to learn about testing and durability and every facet that you can be challenged as a design engineer. And I think if you're in a big company, you don't get that diversity, right? But in our company, I think the balance of design engineers from consultancy backgrounds has been really useful, because their experience just goes through the roof really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And to your point about making clay models, no, we don't make them. We use VR so extensively, and to the point now where we're all in lockdown and we're working from home, all of our lead designers have their own VR set up at home, so we can do shared VR reviews.
Interesting.
And we've given them some pretty powerful hardware to run it on at home. So we can be in VRED or any of the other tools to actually analyze the vehicle designs full size from the comfort of our living room.
That's really interesting. Again, not to make it all about me, but I'm head of product development for Cambridge Sleep Sciences, and that means that the whole time that I've been working at this company, everything has been remote. So if I work up a design that's part of the UI or a new shape, I've got to take pictures and send those across, or say, hey, can you download XD Viewer and I'll send you the prototype. You can muck about with it on your phone. Hadn't really occurred to me, maybe it's worth exploring the VR or at least some kind of AR side of things to be able to demo those products in people's homes, because right now we're stuck to reviewing behind screens.
Mm. I'd say it's a really invaluable tool, especially on something the scale of a vehicle, because seeing it, you know, in the perspective that you see it on a screen doesn't equate to seeing it full size. Mm. And when you're starting to evaluate, you know, along with the sort of physical package box that we create, when you're evaluating the ergonomics of, say, walking onto a bus and taking your seat and going through the payment systems, VR has been a really, really helpful tool for us in that respect.
One question I did want to ask you, because everyone's going to be thinking this when they listen to this, is when are we going to see these on the streets?
So we'll have vehicles doing some evaluations with our customers. So we have vehicles on road this year in December, and then some vehicles early next year doing some operational trials with customers in London, which should be super exciting. Then we move forward through a big year of testing and validation next year, and then early 2022 we'll be selling products to companies around the UK, and then quickly moving over to North America as well.
Brilliant.
That's very cool. And next time I'm in the Alps, which will probably be about 3 years from now, once lockdown dies down, are we hoping to see the ski shuttles and the mountain bike shuttle buses being fully electric?
I hope so. if we can do anything about it, definitely.
Well, if there is anyone out there that can do anything about it, I'd back you guys. So in terms of this journey you've been on, has there been any particular skill set that has been the most, if you think about the organisation, and just for anyone that's kind of would love to work for a rival one day or have seen it from an outside looking in, has there been any particular skill set that's like either been super hard to find or has been the most valuable for you guys in this kind of phase you're in of?
I wouldn't say it's a skill set. I'd say it's a mindset.
Mindset, okay.
It's that ability. I guess if the previous role they had, they were frustrated with, for whatever reason, then that's probably a good starting point. We want people to have left their previous positions because they didn't like the way that company was doing it, or they thought that they wanted to do things differently, or they wanted to challenge themselves to, you know, I don't know, break something and then create a completely new system to be able to challenge the norm. And I think that's, I guess, the sort of thing that I'm personally looking for, is people who have that ability to challenge themselves and to think differently from a traditional design background.
I think, two things. One is mindset. People being okay, being uncomfortable and not knowing what the answer is. And that just comes from a curiosity to go and find out. And the second is product designers have a very broad skill set. And I think I really seeing graduates come out of university with a good depth across lots of different areas of the development process. So people that can go and prototype comfortably, even if it's, you know, we're talking like cardboard or foam board or whatever it might be, versus through to going and solving a problem, doing some mechanical engineering. I think that breadth means that people in Arrival have great value because you're not pocketed into one part of the design process. And some of those valuable creations we've come from people that have just got a very good, broad understanding of the design process, and you put the right experts around them, and they really thrive. Mm.
We have asked this question to everyone, but how has COVID been for you guys? It sounds as if it's been almost business as usual to many respects, but you seem far better prepared than others, and I guess that comes down from obviously the extensive investment and perhaps the mindset of the people that you've got in the organization. It sounds as if it's not held you guys back. Would that be a fair assessment?
To our advantage, we're a slightly chaotic company, and that's a really positive way in that everyone works in a very fluid manner. And so COVID, we've taken it in our stride, to be honest. Teams have all done a really good job of working well. I think that the challenge that we've covered is that we're a very small team, and holding on to that small team dynamic when everyone's remote. And you can't gauge if someone's struggling with a problem or if they've got too much work, or someone assumes that someone else will think of it or take care of something. And those assumptions that people make because it's remote, it does take a toll. But certainly as a company, for us, it's been really good. And we've, now that the lockdown's slightly decreased, we've been able to come in and do some prototyping together. And we just, as I say, we dedicate some time to come and make a decision on a prototype, or we're going to test part on a vehicle. And then all go our separate ways. So it's been a fun process, actually.
Yeah, and
you have to work hard when you're working remotely to try and keep hold of those sort of water cooler moments where the, you know, the chat around, over lunch or whatever, you'll speak to a really interesting design engineer and that will spark ideas and there'll be, you know, new avenues that you can chase because of that conversation. I think, as I say, we are all sort of working with these sort of virtual blinkers on where you are only exposed to the challenges and tasks in front of you. And you really have to work hard to widen that peripheral vision to take on board everything else that's going on in the business that's outside of your remit. I would say that's probably one of the biggest challenges we've had to overcome.
Mm. And from a product lead, COVID has accelerated it, I guess, because when you think of arrival, you do think of the future, don't you? Has COVID, in a sense, been a positive thing from an actual need for the vehicle?
Well, I mean, I wrote an article recently about the impact of COVID on the design of our bus, for example. Mm. And actually, all the things that we were trying to achieve way before COVID, you know, creating a sense of light and space and cleanliness, and all of these things were things that we wrote into the original brief of the vehicle. And the same thing with the van. You know, it's about improving the user experience. And if it's taken something like COVID for everybody to realize how messed up public transport is, then actually, you know, that's not a bad thing, because we kind of identified all of those issues already. Mm. Yes, obviously, you know, we're having to put hand sanitizers on everything we probably wouldn't have thought about. But, you know, I'd say the public transport issue is, it's a great challenge from a designer and a user experience challenge to get everybody back onto public transport, so to create a vehicle that people are excited about using again. Mm-hmm. But it has hit, you know, the potential for, you know, there aren't a lot of transit authorities who are suddenly thinking about, oh, let's expand our bus fleet at the moment. You know, that's something that's maybe gone on the back burner a little bit. Mm-hmm. Whereas the logistics industry completely, you know, that's just gone through the roof. So yeah. The one side of the business is absolutely buoyant. The other one we're having to work slightly harder at to, you know, keep everybody interested and keep that sort of excitement about what we're achieving. But the whole idea around safe, clean transport moving forwards is something that we absolutely was at the heart of our kind of the challenge that we set ourselves when we began the business.
Yeah, it's arrival. If you think back to those original briefs and original purpose of arrival, is it different today than what it was back then? Or is it still to the core values of maybe what it was all about in the early days?
Yeah, it's a good question. We highlighted the strategic challenges we had to solve quite early on. It's always been being able to take complex products like vehicles and scale them without needing billions and billions of pounds of revenue and investment, making products which completely rethink the user experience and ultimately solving the problem of electric vehicles being attainable. And I think those three are still at the essence of what we do. And our ability to design different products will mean that we'll go and solve different problems as we grow as a company in different markets and different regions. But I think those three, you know, those underlying strategies will stand us in good stead as we keep going.
Yeah. And I'd imagine a lot of that's come from, obviously, the visionary. You talked about the visionary earlier in Dennis at the top. Could you give us a bit of insight into the founder or the owner of the business in Dennis Sverdlov and kind of what his vision was at the time and his involvement in the whole process?
Yeah, I mean, he's very, very hands-on. He's the best boss I've ever had. You know, he challenges you as a designer. He is the one who's, you know, telling us, no, that's not pushing it far enough. We need to think better than that. Mm. And that's actually really exciting as a designer working very closely with Dennis. I mean, I think it's only up until recently when the logistics, you know, kind of stopped working out, that he was interviewing every single person in the business.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was a stage gate process you had to go through, and the last one was the sign off from Dennis. And that's kind of attitude of knowing the minutiae of the business in every aspect. So he'll become an expert in batteries, you know, overnight almost, because he has that sort of mind that it enables him to absorb information and then literally start challenging everybody on what they already know about that subject. And that's actually a very, very inspiring thing to be in the company of.
Yeah, and to those that don't know, he's not from a design or engineering background. He's within telecoms, is that right?
Yeah, software background. I mean, which is very much the heart of our business. You know, run the design team, the software aspect of that process is key to the success of these products. The software is effectively, I guess, the gateway, the portal, if you like, that enables the hardware. So, you know, we access all of the services, which are generally software, through the hardware that we're designing. So whether it be the payment system or the app that tells you your bus is late, or all of these things have come through the experience that Dennis and the software team that we have brought to the mix. So software absolutely is at the heart of everything that we're doing.
Yeah. If you think of product design as a term these days, it tends to have a software connotation to it rather than a hardware one. But we won't go over that one again, Drew. It's something we've discussed in the past. just to kind of wrap this up, it'd be good to get your insight, actually. As I'm doing a talk to students on Tuesday, believe it or not, I've been asked to speak to the students of the University of Brighton for some unknown reason. Now, if you think about kind of graduating this year, I imagine it'd be a bit of a crazy time. I didn't know whether you had any industry insight from you guys of what your thoughts are on perhaps landing a first job in design, or just general kind of tips you'd have for the students of today and to perhaps inspire them rather than me just kind of rambling at them for half an hour.
Okay, Jeremy.
I would come back to this idea of a lack of ego. You know, you've got to be confident, and you've got to be confident in presenting your work as well, but be humble about it, and don't be precious about it. So one of the things I often tell students is you're not creating a piece of sculpture. You know, this isn't your piece of work. This is for the greater good. So if we need to tear it up and start again, then don't get precious about it and move on to the next challenge. And be able to get your ideas down quickly, however that might be, verbally, on paper, or as a sketch, as a CAD sketch. Do it quickly and don't worry too much about the fidelity early on, and then nurture that fidelity as the process grows and as you get closer to the sort of the concept vision, if you like. You can then start to firm up on things. But don't see CAD as being the end game. Don't kind of hang all your hopes on the fact that you can suddenly model everything amazingly. It doesn't make you a great designer. It's like giving someone a camera and expecting them to be a brilliant photographer. You know, it's just that's the hardware and the software that enables that creative process. So don't get too hung up about being an expert in CAD early on. Learn the craft, learn the skills of model making, learn the skills of sketching. Go and do a life drawing class. That's one of the key elements. You know, understanding proportion and three dimensions and how light models form. Go and do life drawing, or go and do still life, and go back to basics. I would say I think that is absolutely. I think the biggest lesson I learned as a designer is learning to draw, learning to communicate my designs, not apologizing for my designs. So many designers I hear going, well, it wasn't quite what I wanted to do, and they are apologizing for the design even before I've seen it, and that doesn't make for the best presentation. So be confident, but be humble, I would say.
Okay,
it's easy as a design graduate to want to present yourself as the finished article, like I can do this, I've done this, I can do, and that's. As someone that's trying to grow a team that needs people to come in and solve problems, you want the opposite. You want someone to come in and they fully know and they communicate that they are a sponge just willing to soak up knowledge. But I think that has to be backed up with designers need to have a great curiosity for lots of different things. I think it's very easy to want to be a niche designer and so fill your Instagram with beautiful sketches and fill your Instagram with the right brands and stuff. And I think you can see substance in designers, and you can see people that haven't got the right substance that you need. And that comes from a curiosity across knowing what businesses are like and how they work. You know, which kind of businesses do you find yourself appealing towards, and why? What are their principles behind the business and the products? An understanding of and a curiosity for how things work and the kind of and how people interact with products. And to your point, that's physical and digital. And I think if you can in an interview, show off your curiosity for how things work and what you do, then that stands far better than a beautiful page in a portfolio will. If ever a design graduate turns up to an interview without parts to put on the table in front of me, there's already a cap over there. and that sounds quite brutal, but I interview from people with license, they come in and they put out these great big rough looking prototypes and I can't tell what it is to begin with, and they just start talking it through. Yeah. And you don't even care about the CV or the portfolio, because you can just see that this person's got a great interest for how things, you know, for solving problems. And I think if you can communicate that genuine earnest, I would really advise designers not to try and map out a path yourself too early. Like, broad design is broad.
It can totally. I would agree with that. And you know, try and get as many things as your portfolio across the range of products as you possibly can. I mean, I think the most disparate things I ever had in my portfolios from my first job was designing a syringe for drawing off amniotic fluid from the womb 1 week. And then the following week, I was put on to designing My Little Pony's diving board. So, you know, but you know what? The challenges were the same. You think like the user. And in the first instance, you try and put yourself into the mindset of a 35-year-old surgeon, and the next you're trying to think like a 7-year-old child. So it's a weird mix of skills that you have to have as a designer to really succeed. But I would say, you know, put yourself in the heart of the user is absolutely fundamental to understanding the challenge of designing the product.
As I say, thank you guys for coming on. In all seriousness, when we started this off, I genuinely put Arrival at the top of my list of people that I wanted to talk to. It's you probably hear this every day. It is great what you guys are doing, and I know you're talking about being humble and stuff, and you must get a bit tired of people saying how inspirational and exciting it must be, but you know, genuinely what you guys are doing could change transport forever. So best of luck for any of the challenges that, you know, happen, and we look forward to seeing the evolution of this journey, and hopefully seeing it on our streets over the next couple of years.
Quick one, in terms of your insights into designers and the design industry, how do you think a team which can easily be portrayed as a vehicle manufacturer, how does that, do people see us as, you know, do people think, oh, they're designing vehicles, or I don't really like cars, I want to go, you know?
No, I think.
Well, I was just about to say, actually, for me, what I found really exciting once I started having a little look into Arrival was not the thing that you were making, it was the way in which you approached it. And you could see that it was all design driven. Mm. I think there are so many industries out there that go, well, you know what, we've made this way for a million years, so we're going to, like, see no reason to do any of that differently. Clearly vans is one of those things as well. Yeah. Horses, of course. Yeah.
There was a reason why, you know, design was one of the first teams that Dennis put together. Mm. It's because it's a design-led organization, and everybody, whether they have had a formal design training or not, thinks like a designer, thinks has that kind of lateral thought process, has that design thinking kind of mentality, if you like, of how to do things better.
I always use the example of Logitech as something that adopted that, and then the commercial kind of success of
He's doing amazing things over at Logitech.
But to answer your question, Patrick, I think Arrival is probably seen as probably arguably the pinnacle now of like the design scene from a hardware standpoint in London. I think most, if not, you know, a high percentage of people would love to work for Arrival. I think it's probably more the other way now, where you're probably a little bit more selective of, you know, of who can come in because of the standards that have been set. But to answer your question, I think Arrival is seen and positioned itself as more of than just a car, you know, a vehicle manufacturer.
We've always talked of ourselves as a technology company that happens to focus on mobility. Mm. You know, that's the challenge that we're chasing at the moment.
And yeah,
who's to say in 10 years' time we'll be doing something? You know,
the example that was given to me in a meeting about, I think it was about 3 years ago. So at this time, I don't know if you're probably still in stealth mode, and someone said to me, I can't remember who it was, but they said, remember the time you first picked up a Nokia, and it was that kind of flip phone moment, and it was like, wow, amazing. They kind of described Tesla as the Nokia, and they described Apple as Arrival. So when you picked up the first iPhone, and again, it was that wow moment of, you know, just the future, you know, of the iPhone. That's how that was described to me as kind of 3 years ago, of a rival are the Apple and Tesla are the Nokia. That was something that was said to me in a meeting once. So I've always used that analogy of kind of describing the...
That's worse companies to be associated with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So as I said before, obviously, you know, hopefully the... You'll overcome the next set of challenges that I'm sure that will happen, particularly during this kind of testing phase. It's obviously a big year for you guys. And yeah, thanks for the support on the pod as well. It's really appreciated.
It was awesome to chat with Patrick and Jeremy over at Arrival. If you liked what you heard, track us down on the socials and let us know what you think. Next time out for us will be the Design Truth Christmas special. Yes, it really is the most wonderful time of the year. More importantly, stay safe, everyone, and catch up soon.